ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Anthony Albanese continues his visit to China, following in the footsteps of another Labor PM, Gough Whitlam. Also, Tasmania's political leaders clash in a debate ahead of this Saturday's state election. And in Sydney Harbour, an inquisitive whale makes an unexpected appearance.
Look, they're all stopping to watch for the whale. How cool is that?
I just took the photo probably of my lifetime, the whale tail, Sydney Harbour Bridge and the Opera House with sunset. It doesn't get better than that.
As his visit to China continues, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has today emphasised it's in Australia's national interest to expand its relationship with that nation. He's been forced, though, to clarify his government's position on Taiwanese independence after a misleading statement from Chinese authorities. As Luke Radford reports, Mr Albanese has today visited the Great Wall of China, just as Labor PM Gough Whitlam did in the 1970s.
Rugby league fans sometimes feel like wherever they go, they'll find someone wearing a South Sydney Rabbitohs kit. And today, even the Great Wall of China lived up to that billing. Bedecked in a Rabbitohs cap, the Prime Minister continued his whiplash tour of China.
One of the wonders of the world, some 21,000 kilometres long. This particular section is built in 1505. We are literally standing on history. History in recognition of the longevity of Chinese culture and Chinese achievement.
With his meeting with Chinese leader Xi Jinping now out of the way, cultural diplomacy was on the cards. It's perhaps no accident that the part of the Great Wall Anthony Albanese visited today was the same section visited by then-opposition leader Gough Whitlam in 1971, after he declared he'd recognise the People's Republic of China if he won office, something he achieved the next year.
Yesterday was an opportunity as well for us to develop the relationship between Australia and China. I've said consistently that we'll cooperate where we can, disagree where we must, but engage in our national interest. It is very clear that it is in our national interest for us to have a positive relationship with China, where there are differences, to talk about them but not be defined by them.
Experts say the Prime Minister's choice of destination and the words he used were carefully chosen. Paul Strangio is an Emeritus Professor of Politics at Monash University. He says Gough Whitlam's decision to visit China had big implications, not just for Australia, but also the world.
This step of Whitlam in mid-1971, effectively to go out on a limb and visit China, was daring, it was significant, it was bold, and it must be also noted that he was really the first Western political figure to visit communist China at that time. So it was a meeting seen as having international significance.
Paul Strangio says that significance wouldn't be lost on Anthony Albanese.
Under Scott Morrison, of course, the relationship badly soured, and it's been Labor again since Anthony Albanese came to power in 2022 that has had to rebuild the relationship, put it on a more stable footing again. So I think, you know, there is a very important symbolic, historical underpinning to this moment.
Just like Gough Whitlam, Anthony Albanese faces a difficult diplomatic balancing act, treading a fine line between the United States and China. He's been asked by reporters what role Australia would play if war erupted over the island of Taiwan, which China considers its own sovereign territory. China's foreign ministry put out a statement yesterday claiming Anthony Albanese had rejected Taiwan independence. That's not entirely accurate. What the Prime Minister actually said was that he supports things as they are right now.
What we do is continue to support a one-China policy. We support the status quo. By definition, we don't support any unilateral action on Taiwan. That's been our position for a long period of time. Nothing's different there.
It's not the only difficult subject the Prime Minister has been forced to tackle on this trip. The PM has also advocated for the release of Chinese-Australian writer Yang Hengjun, who's been imprisoned in China for 6 years on spying charges. Executive Director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, Justin Bassey, says it's one of many challenges Australia faces on China.
We have to be upfront with the Australian public that economics is one thing, but there are a series of security issues and human rights issues. China continues to detain wrongfully an Australian citizen over 6 years now. They, every day they breach international rules in the South China Sea against the Philippines. They systematically abuse minorities like the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. All these things are still there.
Justin Bassey is the Executive Director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Luke Radford reporting. With the Tasmanian state election just 3 days away, the leaders of the two major parties have gone head-to-head in the only debate of the campaign today, hosted by Sky News and the Hobart Mercury newspaper. It's the second state election in just 16 months. The poll was triggered by a no-confidence motion brought and won by the Labor opposition leader Dean Winter against the Liberal Premier Jeremy Rockliffe. ABC reporter Ellen Coulter is in Hobart. Ellen, what were the main topics raised in the debate?
Well, each leader got an opening statement, which for Tasmanians may have felt very familiar. We had the Premier Liberal leader, Jeremy Rockliffe, talking about the reasons for this election. He has been consistently pointing the finger at the opposition leader, Labor leader Dean Winter, for this, saying he didn't need to move the no confidence motion that kicked off the chain of events leading to this campaign, and saying, you know, Tasmanians didn't want to be here in the first place. The Labor leader, Dean Winter, on the other hand, opened saying Tasmanians need a fresh start, which is something we've heard a lot during this campaign. They then proceeded into subjects that have really dominated the campaign, talking about why are we here? Did we really need this? And then Dean Winter, the Labor leader, reiterating his reasons for this. And one that we delved into a lot was the Spirit of Tasmania debacle, which is basically expecting two brand new shiny fairies down here. They were due to arrive, but there wasn't a berth built for them. Also mentioning the budget, the dire state of the budget was one of the reasons that Dean Winter moved a no-confidence motion in the Premier, setting off the chain of events that led to the election campaign. That certainly came up. And during this campaign, we haven't seen huge financial promises, probably because of that, because one of the key reasons has been the dire state of the budget, this ballooning debt and deficit. But that certainly didn't stop the leaders accusing each other of that during this debate. And here's a little bit of that, starting with the Labor leader, Dean Winter.
And during this election campaign, this Premier hasn't announced one single cent of savings. In fact, he just kept spending. Yesterday, he went down and spent another $15 million worth of Tasmanian taxpayer money. So here's what the difference is.
Dean, you've been spending like a drunken sailor over the course of the last week in a desperate attempt to improve your ratings in the polls. Now, seriously, you promised not to pork barrel. I've never seen so much pork in all my life.
That's the Tasmanian Premier Liberal leader, Jeremy Rockliffe. And Ellen, how did you and other analysts feel the leaders performed?
Well, I suppose it's a matter of opinion. As you heard there, certainly Mr. Rockliffe was able to land a few blows early. He's been in Parliament for 23 years, and that experience really showed, especially early on in the debate. He certainly had no issues interrupting Mr. Winter, which was clearly frustrating for Dean Winter, and it took some time for him to warm up and start getting his own back. That said, he was able to start throwing his own questions at Mr. Rockliffe, and a few of those were quite pertinent and quite consistent. I wouldn't say either of the leaders were particularly rattled at any point. This was a debate that didn't have a live audience there. Afterwards, the Greens leader, Rosalie Woodruff, who wasn't part of this debate, said all she heard was politicians interrupting each other, who were more interested in politics than anything. I think if you were talking about performance and delivery, they were both pretty much on message. We didn't have any surprises. We didn't have any sort of breakdowns. I think if anyone had watched performances from Mr. Rockliffe and Mr. Winter in Tasmanian Parliament before, they pretty much would have got what they were expecting.
Now, you say no surprises, but did anything new, any new information come out of the debate at all?
The one new pledge to come out of today was from Labor leader Dean Winter. Labor during the campaign has promised 10 new bulk billing GP clinics. And today he said he'd deliver those in 2 years or he would resign. Other than that, there were the topics that the two major parties are largely in agreement on or have little discernible difference on. So talking things like the Macquarie Point Stadium that has been quite contentious down here for a new AFL team, support for the salmon industry, native forest logging. They were sort of on, you know, very similar pathways there. There was also, I mean, the two signature policies of the campaign have been Labor promising the new bulk billing GP clinics. Also, the Liberals have this sort of signature policy of a state insurance business. And that was something that was certainly where Dean Winter was able to really throw a few questions about the detail of that to the Premier Jeremy Rockliffe.
What we will be doing is ensuring competition in a failed market. And the premiums of Tasinsure will be reinvested.
Do you have a
back
business case or costings?
Thank you, Dean.
Or any modelling at all?
Thank you, Dean.
Any information?
Back in, our insurance premiums, of course, will be reinvested back in to keep insurance premiums low.
The Tasmanian Premier, Jeremy Rockliffe. And Ellen, away from today's debate, what are the experts predicting the election result will be on Saturday?
Well, I think in short, potentially not much different to where we were at before we headed into this campaign. We've seen some polling. None of it is showing a resounding majority, certainly not. And if you speak to analysts in Tasmania, certainly most of them would be saying, well, chances of a minority government again are probably well and truly on the cards.
ABC reporter Ellen Coulter in Hobart. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, a humpback whale makes a splash at Circular Quay in Sydney.
What it also does do, it just teaches us things that we just don't know. So these animals, although they are capable of making a huge migratory journey from Antarctica up here, how do they know how to do it?
The recent collapse of two prominent offshore wind farm projects has experts raising doubts about the viability of wind as a major source of clean energy. The Gippsland Dawn project off the Victorian coast is the latest project scrapped by developers. Industry figures are urging the federal and state governments to sort out the issues plaguing the sector. Kathleen O'Connor has more.
With clean energy touted as the way of the future, investor Jai Merchandani saw huge financial potential in both wind and solar.
There's still excellent opportunities for the right project.
Jai Merchandani invests in companies that develop offshore wind projects and has seen the challenges.
After COVID, we saw that increase in inflation and interest rates from a really depressed levels, and given the capital intensity of a lot of these projects, the cost to deliver them increased significantly, and the profitability of a lot of projects were compromised.
More recently, Jai Merchandani says Donald Trump's decision to stop all new offshore wind projects has caused ripple effects around the globe.
It was expected that the U.S., the increase in development from the U.S. was going to increase the supply of a lot of the parts that are associated with these offshore wind projects, and in turn was meant to decrease the price and cost of a lot of these items. That didn't happen, and so now we're still at this, I guess, elevated price point or cost base, making many projects unfeasible. And we're definitely seeing, you know, delays and cancellations here in Australia as well as a result of that.
The latest plan to fall over, a major offshore wind farm project off the coast of Gippsland in eastern Victoria called Gippsland Dawn. It was one of many projects around the world by major developer Blue Float Energy. In a statement yesterday, the company said it's packing up many developments around the globe because offshore wind is no longer commercially viable. Earlier this month, another international developer pulled the pin on its project off the northeast coast of Tasmania. It casts a shadow over plans to establish a nationwide offshore wind industry. Tony Wood is an expert in energy and climate change at the Grattan Institute.
Unfortunately for Victoria and Australia, this is not the first of the wind or renewable energy projects to be cancelled. We've seen similar things happen onshore in solar projects in Queensland. And of course, we've also seen quite a few green hydrogen projects cancelled because they couldn't get access to low-cost renewables. So there's been some challenges here. And I think, unfortunately, what that means is everybody thinks, oh, my God, this is all too hard and we should stop. Well, that's not the right answer.
Tony Wood says it's a setback and is calling for government to intervene to evaluate the impact these challenges are having on unfinished projects.
The government, state government and Victoria and federal government, together with the project, the industry and the Australian Energy Market Operator, whose job it is to monitor how are we going against our renewable energy targets, against our emissions reduction targets, need to revisit and update our understanding of where things sit. Are we on track to be able to achieve our targets, or do we have to seriously rethink some of these things? And we're never going to be cheap and easy. And the trick here is that we can't just turn around and forget about it. I mean, we've got a real challenge here to address climate change.
Federal Minister for Climate Change and Energy, Chris Bowen, says there's still a high level of investor interest in Australia's emerging offshore wind industry, especially in the Gippsland zone. Tony Wood agrees and says there's still a bright future for offshore wind in Australia.
I do not want to underestimate that a project like this falling over is not bad news. Of course it is. But that doesn't mean that the industry itself is going to fall over. I think, you know, offshore wind is a well-recognised technology around the world. It has its advantages and disadvantages, and it's a matter of finding the right way of supporting that project. So I think I'm not suggesting for a second that the offshore wind industry is about to fold up its tent and go home in Australia, but I think there's going to be a lot of serious reviews, and that means the offshore wind proponents, and there's quite a few of them in Australia, together with the both governments, federal and state, will be having a pretty serious look at, okay, well, this is where we are now. What do we need to do? And I don't think we've yet seen an absolute pragmatic review of what this project failure and other recent ones means for the prospects of offshore wind to contribute to Australia's energy transition.
Tony Wood from the Grattan Institute, Kathleen O'Connor, with that report. To Western Australia now, where scientists are urging the state government to change its program of planned forest burns. Documents obtained by the ABC through a Freedom of Information request have revealed that nearly 100 rare trees were lost in a managed fire last summer. Giant red tingles are eucalypts, and the only place in the world they grow is in a forest area known as the Valley of the Giants, about 400 kilometres south of Perth. Andrew Chounding filed this report.
This forest on Western Australia's south coast is home to some of the most unique animals and plant life on the planet.
So this is the map of the tingle distribution. That is all the tingle on the whole planet.
But conservationist Bart Lebbing worries prescribed burns in the region are becoming increasingly destructive.
We don't think fire is a bad thing in the Australian landscape. However, how it is managed is very crucial. The severity we see of recent prescribed burns or prescribed burns in the last decade are very destructive to both flora and fauna, and also the cultural aspects of the landscape.
In December, WA's bushfire mitigation program was called into question after the organisation responsible, the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions, the DBCA, lit a burn that felled almost 100 rare red tingle trees. The DBCA insists the burn was a success despite the damage caused. That's a claim being challenged by Professor Stephen Hopper from the Lewin Group, a consortium of WA's top environmental scientists.
We would like to have the scientific evidence debated on the table with the government officers who are driving the fire program, hopefully with the ministers present as well, so that a clear review of the evidence could be made.
At the time, the department said publicly it was aware of one large tree felled in the fire, but internal DBCA documents obtained by the ABC confirm 114 trees were felled, including 95 red tingles. The fire burned 99% of the prescribed area with a greater severity than mitigation burns in the same block 3 decades ago. Now the Lewin Group is calling for an urgent change to the program to avoid another mass felling after 19 parcels of forest were earmarked for burning over the next 3 years, including 4 with stands of red tingle trees.
What we're recommending is that they don't burn wholesale blocks in the stuff that's well removed from life and property assets, rather burns around the periphery of them to afford some protection from incoming fire, but not taking out literally tens, if not hundreds, of trees if applied in the forest itself. That's what we've recommended consistently to the government, and as yet they haven't responded in a way that indicates a change is afoot.
WA's new Environment Minister Matthew Swinburne has declined requests for an interview. A statement from the Minister's office highlighted the government's legislated responsibility to protect communities and the environment from bushfires. It also states the burn program is based on 60 years of data with new research underway. Professor Hopper calls that a diversionary tactic.
The Minister's solution has been to park it for 10 years, and he's given the department a bit of money for new research to be done. We think the scientific evidence is already compelling.
That data includes findings from a government-lit tingle burn in the 90s, recommending that no more than 10 trees be felled per 100 hectares. Nathan Anderson from the University of Tasmania says those findings are now being ignored.
When you look at the previous burn that was in there, there were 30 trees that collapsed, and that was classified, that was a concerning loss of trees, and we're at more than three times that amount for the same area. We're looking at a concern that was raised in the 90s, and it's still a concern today. And if we don't address that, then it's only going to get worse.
Nathan Anderson from the University of Tasmania. That report from Andrew Chounding. Well, while most visitors to Sydney Harbour are there to admire the bridge and the Opera House, another spectacular sight was drawing plenty of attention today. A humpback whale was causing a splash at Circular Quay. Our reporter Tanya Dendrinos was there.
I love this. Look, they're all stopping to watch for the whale.
This is one very excited wildlife scientist on Sydney Harbour, watching the famous ferries stop so passengers can catch a glimpse of the area's newest icon. It's been a day of discovery for Macquarie University's Dr. Vanessa Perotta.
I just took the photo probably of my lifetime, the whale tail, Sydney Harbour Bridge and the Opera House with sunset. It doesn't get better than that. But what it also does do, it just teaches us things that we just don't know. So these animals, although they are capable of making that huge migratory journey from Antarctica up here, how do they know how to do it? And what is fascinating about this harbour to this one individual? So as well as keeping an eye for its safety and other vessels so they don't hit it, we're learning more about its behaviour. But it's really interesting. And because we've had effort out here, I've heard penguins. And I've also made a really fabulous discovery that the common dolphins, not bottlenose dolphins, but common dolphins that we see offshore come into the harbour. I personally didn't know that.
This 10-metre-long humpback whale was on quite the harbour cruise today, spotted not just in Circular Quay, but other harbourside locations including Watson's Bay and Balmoral. Ben Byrne is a photographer for Whale Watching Sydney.
Maybe once or twice in a year, each season, we might see a whale come in, but not usually this far in. Yeah, for it to come this far in to see it in Circular Quay, that's something I have never seen before in my life. A lot of people, it's the first time that they see a whale, so it's a great deal of excitement for them. But then they also didn't realise how lucky they are to be able to see a whale this far in the harbour. Everyone was sort of joyful about it and such. Everyone was excited. But yeah, it's just, I guess some people just don't realise how unique an experience it is.
While it may be a spectacular sight for onlookers, in such a busy harbour, there are also major risks. Mel Hall is from the New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service.
This is our second event of a whale coming in as far as Circular Quay and the Harbour Bridge in the last 2 years. So fingers crossed it stays at one a year. The greatest risk is a collision between the whale and any vessels, recreational or commercial vessels, and it could be either way. It could be the whale collides with something or a vessel collides with the whale. Either way, the consequences to the whale and potentially the passengers of any vessel can range from minor through to serious.
Ensuring the safety of the whale and the greater public has been a coordinated effort by National Parks and Maritime New South Wales.
We've had good eyes from our vessel crews on the whale, and it does not appear to be entangled. We should be able to see that entanglement if it was. It doesn't appear to be injured, so there's no external marks of concern. If it continues to linger, we'll continue to monitor it and start to, you know, liaise further with vets if we think it's internally compromised in some way.
As light fades, that mission becomes more complex. The hope is, after a day frolicking in the harbour, this whale will safely make its way back to the migratory corridor.
Let's hope so. Tanya Dendrinos with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Will Australia join a US war against China if it invades Taiwan? That's the stark question Anthony Albanese faced during his delicate visit to Beijing, where he's trying to strengthen trade and business ties. Today, the ABC's newly appointed Global Affairs editor, Laura Tingle, joins us from Beijing. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.